So I'm glad to know from the last talk that Google tortures junior SREs, so you can all tweet that out. Just kidding. But you know that's going to be the highlight, right? So my name's Damon Edwards. This talk is essentially about the enterprise. And you might tell yourself, well, I don't work in an enterprise. And you just wait. Because wherever you're working today, if you're successful long enough, that history of success, you will turn into an enterprise, which in my book means that you've been around long enough to collect multiple generations of technologies, of tools, of people, of skills. You'll probably have multiple business lines, some homegrown, some by acquisition. So that is what I mean by the enterprise and all the complexity that comes with it. And this is about the troubles that you see a lot of enterprises who are taking the early leap into SRE are facing and what we can do about it. So as I said, I'm Damon Edwards. My history, I used to be the managing partner of a pretty well-known DevOps and operations improvement consultancy. We were the ops towards dev people, kind of a rarity in the DevOps world. But through that and through a lot of work in the community, got to really see inside a lot of interesting companies, a lot of household names, a lot of high flyers, a lot of not so high flyers, little companies, big companies, everything in between. So that's kind of where I've kind of gained my perspective on the industry. And now I'm one of the co-founders of Rundeck. We make operations tools. So if you see something's going on in the industry, you see a lot of these companies, enterprises at conferences, right? They're saying, oh, look at all the stuff we've got going on. We've got digital, we've got agile, we've got DevOps, CI/CD, right? We've got all the new cool technologies. Aren't we the greatest? Everything's go, go, go. But the reality is, if you kind of look behind the scenes and you talk to the folks in the operations side of the house, things aren't so great, right? They're in this really difficult position, this squeeze between, on one side, you've got all the digital and DevOps transformation coming, I guess this way, pushing down, saying, go, 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 open things up, right? Give us more access, decouple, let us have at it. And on the other side of the house, coming from the other direction, often from the same business mandates, is, whoa, lock things down, right? Don't be the next hack, don't be the next breach, keep us out of the news, right? We don't want to be those folks, do we not be the next major outage, So operations as a field has been squeezed between these two positions, and especially in the enterprise, we have to deal with all the legacy and the organizational complexity. So they all come to this conclusion, like, we're not seeing the results we expected. We've done all these things, but why are things still taking too long, breaking too often, and generally costing us too much? And they say, hey, have you heard of this SRE thing, right? Google does it. It's got to be great, right? So, everyone's like, ooh, what do we do? Well, we've got these systems administrators, right? And we got a lot of them. So what are we going to do, right? Let's make them SREs. That's how we're going to be like Google, right? It's going to be fantastic. Thank you. Wow. You guys are an easy crowd. I like this. I feel like you've been in this position before, right? So, but this is the reality. You're going to love this, right? Here's what happens, right? Pony hair boss comes in and says, you're now an SRE. And the person looks up from their pile of ITIL books, and they're trying to figure out the cab calendar and, this long process. And they said, okay, you're going to use code, and you're going to be better at ops, right? So it's kind of this head jerk of, okay, great, we've got this new title. So what happens, right? Well, in the old sysadmin world, right, what happened? We're always overloaded, constantly firefighting, right? We're spending our whole life waiting in ticket queues, either opening tickets for other people or answering tickets. Things break, they break again, and just for good measure, we break it again, right? And everyone's super busy, nothing ever gets better, right? And so the boss is like, everything takes too long, costs too much, and breaks too often, right? But good news, we've got this new SRE thing we're going to do, and can anybody spot the difference, right? It's exactly the same, right? We're overloaded, constant firefighting, and it's just a much of pain in the ass than it ever was. But the bad news is your employees all have SRE titles, so now their LinkedIn is blowing up and they're all leaving you to go make more money somewhere somewhere else, right? So, the reality is changing job titles and adding individual skills doesn't make systems administrators into SREs. Right, just because we're using observability and we've got some new, automation tools, doesn't make your folks SREs. Calling them SREs doesn't make it either. The principles of SRE, is really, I think, what sets SRE apart from the classic enterprise operations model. So I stole these from a presentation that Stephen Thorne did at the DevOps Enterprise Summit, which is a great conference to send people to who are in the enterprise and want to learn these new things. And, you know, the first one is, you know, SRE needs service level objectives with consequences, right? I mean, full stop, this is kind of the key core principle. It's worth kind of taking a little side detour here on what that actually means. So, you know, if you aren't familiar with what service level objectives or error budgets are, I'm assuming if you're here, you probably do. But you can imagine there is this service level indicator. It's some, you know, kind of a business impacting measurable thing that the, you know, the business and the developers and operations get together and says, you know, this is what we believe needs to happen in our business. And there is some objective, right? And this is what the business will tolerate. Let's say it's, if whatever it is, it's 95%. Then we have that difference. The difference between perfection and that service level objective is what's called an error budget. And, you know, it's got some really interesting ideas around it. The idea being that, you know, that is time, that is capacity for us to use to try to push things forward, to try to innovate and improve what we're doing. But if we fall below that, we've blown our budget, and real consequences have to happen. And this is really, I think, where it becomes fascinating, because if you think about it, in the enterprise world, they have SLAs, right? SLAs are a penalty on operations, usually defined by somebody else. You must do this, or else there will be some penalty against you. And if you think about the most fascinating part of the error budget idea is that it's really about shared responsibility. That if I'm a developer, if I'm in the business, if I'm in operations, hopefully called an SRE, we're agreeing that this is a shared responsibility, that we have to keep this level above the service level objective, or else there's real consequences. You know, some people talk about giving the pager back to developers or not doing new feature development. Whatever it is, all three of us have to agree we stop and have to fix this problem, not just ops is dealing with the problem. So that's number one, right? SREs need service level objectives with consequences. I mean, everybody has to agree to fix it. Number two, SREs need time to make tomorrow better than today, right? This goes to the toil idea, which I'll discuss later. But the idea that if we're stuck in that firefighting mode, we're never going to have time to improve how we work. The whole point of having SRE is to get that engineering time to improve how we work. So if we don't have that time, we're not really doing SRE. And this one, too, especially is a foreign concept in the enterprise, which is SREs have the ability to regulate their workload, right? That there's actually a self-regulation and a self-healing or correcting to how SREs work. And there's a lot of kind of empowerment in that statement that's very kind of foreign to the command and control nature of many classic enterprises. So I'm going to look at these three principles as we go through this presentation. But again, if you want to watch this presentation, I just talked to him in the hallway. He's here. He's going to be speaking tomorrow. He says it's just as good as the one he did at DevOps Enterprise. But these slides will be posted, and you can watch his presentation on that. So there's these four forces that undermine SRE principles. Checking on my time here. And these are really, I call these the four horsemen of the kind of enterprise operations apocalypse. But it's silos, queues, excessive toil, and low trust. These are the things that are going to screw you up. So let's talk about the first one here, silos. So silos is a word that comes up a lot. I think it's kind of misunderstood. People automatically assume that a silo is a team or some kind of organizational structure. And the org structure side of a silo is really kind of a secondary concern. The bigger concern is how is somebody working, right? So if you think about how someone's working on their own, they've got their own backlog, right? They've got probably set priorities set by, you know, some boss. They've got their own kind of information or context they're working in, and they've got their own tools and processes. But the problem is nothing lives in isolation, right? Especially in the enterprise. You always need something from somebody else. And this is where the silo part comes in. It's, I need something from somebody else who can do something for me. And the problem is they have their own backlog, their own priorities, their own tools, you know, their own you know, management chain. And this is where the silo effects start to take hold, because these people end up working out of context from each other. And as organizations grow, this is a natural occurring force. We're going to put like with like, because that's what human beings like to do. And when you put them together, they're going to turn inward and start optimizing what they do. And that's how these disconnects start to happen. And specifically, you know, it's these breaks in context. I see things one way, you see things another way. It's breaks in process. You know, even though we use the same terms, we might do things a little bit differently, or I just have totally different terms. Breaks in tooling. How many times see people look at the same thing, like Ansible, and just, you know, decide to do it a totally different way because they're, you know, they need to serve their own purpose. And then also this mismatch in capacity, right? I mean, how many DBAs do we have? How many network engineers do we have? How many, you know, security specialists do we have? They often, you know, there's a capacity mismatch between these different silos. And these silos interfere with our feedback loops, right? So in the DevOps world, it talked a lot about dev and ops, right? Like, and then Gene Kim's, Patrick Dubois, and Jez Humble, and John Willis made a great book called The DevOps Handbook. It kind of catalogs a lot of these, you know, DevOps delivery principles. And they talk a lot about flow, right? You want to flow from dev to ops. You want to start to build these feedback loops and then continuously improve over time to improve these feedback loops. But this happens really in any kind of context, right? In operations, when you have things from, I need an environment from somebody, or I need a firewall change, or I need a database change, you know, there's somebody producing something for somebody else to consume, and you want to, you know, consistently have those feedback loops, but having these silos, you know, puts these breaks and makes the feedback loops a lot longer. We know that longer feedback loops equal lower quality. And then silos also have this weird condition that arises out of these kind of siloed organizations, is the people in these silos end up becoming like, basically like a temp agency, right? Oh, I'm a DBA. I get a ticket, I parachute in, I do my best job to fix something, I'm back home, I get another ticket, I go parachute in, try to fix something, and you end up kind of bouncing around the organization. And what ends up happening is you get a lot of semi-manual, a lot of one-offs, snowflakes, we call them, a lot of, you know, kind of manual efforts, because you're always kind of jumping from one context to the other. And this, the management focus of those types of teams ends up being, this is why, you know, they call operations, you know, the VPs of no, because their whole point is trying to protect the capacity of that team, because they're just going to get slammed with these kind of one-off requests, and you're always kind of stuck in that constant mode. So if we think about our SRE principles and silos, you know, they, you know, can an org have service level objectives with consequences? That's really hard to do in any meaningful way in a highly siloed organization. The idea of, you know, sharing any kind of responsibility is a foreign thing, and very difficult to do when everything's broken up. They have time to make tomorrow better than today, right? You know, the siloed labor pools, the disconnected processes and tooling, slow feedback loops, that's going to basically what you see today, which is, you know, why operations never has any capacity, right? It's always consumed by what's around it. So not much luck there. And do they have the ability to regulate their workload? With all these, you know, things we described before, you know, you're struggling to keep up that demand. You're unable to protect that capacity. It's really going to undermine these your move to SRE. So number two here, queues, right? So, all right, we got these silos, so what do we do, right? What's our main go-to thing to control our all those disconnects and mismatches that we have? Well, we drop this lovely thing in called a ticket queue, right? And we all know how well that works, right? You fill out a ticket, you know, it sits there forever. You get a project manager to go bug somebody to handle it. They get back to it. They, you know, they ask you 3-4 questions. You miss the window. You got to wait for the next week. They finally deliver something to you. It's not what you wanted. Do you fix it yourself, or do you send it back? And around we go. And, you know, the reality is that ticket queues, we treat them like they're free, and we keep putting them everywhere, right? And the reality is, if you study other fields, you know, there's real math behind why queues are actually very expensive. There's, you know, queuing theory. If you look in manufacturing, if you look in kind of physical world product development, you know, there's a lot of conversation around, you know, why queues are expensive, especially for work in progress, right? Now, obviously, a backlog is one thing, but once work starts, interjecting these queues is a very expensive thing. And there's a guy named Don Reinertsen who wrote a fantastic book called The Principles of Product Development Flow. It's where I stole this from. And if you really want to kind of learn the science behind why queues and so many of the things we talk about, like small batch sizes and stuff like that, why they're actually problematic, he's a fantastic source. But, you know, he talks about how there's these real economic costs to queues, right? Longer cycle times, this makes sense, right? We're introducing delay by putting things in a queue. Anytime we introduce delay or drag out those feedback loops, we increase the risk, right? There's more variability because people are kind of blind to the requester. The requester is kind of blind to the person fulfilling it. So we're going to have a lot more variability in there. That also increases risk. We have more overhead. We've got to manage these queues, right? We need to have the project managers, and we need to have everybody pushing, a lot of push going on to get things through these queues. We're going to have lower quality. That's because of the variability and the increased risk. And also, there's an interesting one that I didn't really notice till he mentioned it, is less motivation, right? The longer somebody has to wait to see the outcome of their work, the less motivated they're going to be, right? If the developer, you know, puts something in and it's finished and you don't see it, you know, go live for, you know, 6 months, you just kind of lose that motivation. You lose that feedback loop. Same side on the operation side. You do these little things. You don't really know what the other side is. You lose that kind of motivation to do your work. So queues are very, very expensive. And so also, we spend all this time, you know, kind of in the lean sort of ideas thinking, let's build a better picture of the value stream. Let's get people to understand the totality of what they're working on and how things work from start to finish. So we've kind of building this clear picture of our system. And then we do this great thing, in which we explode it and put it into all of these queues, right? So we've actually kind of totally disintegrated and obfuscated this whole, all this value stream building and systems thinking work that we're trying to do. And then lastly, queues become snowflake makers, right? Which a snowflake is a great little term that means, you know, each thing you do, like imagine a snowflake, right? Everyone is technically perfect. It's beautiful, right? But it's totally unreproducible and brittle. And anytime you're doing kind of semi-manual or manual work, especially these one-offs in this kind of siloed labor pool style of working, you're producing snowflakes, right? People are touching things individually. They're doing the kind of one-off. It might be perfect for that situation in there, but it's not working sort of in the broader, they're working out of context from each other. And not to mix metaphors, but these snowflakes become like time bombs, right? It's like these little things that are differences in the environment that people stumble along later when it trips them up. Or worse, you can't automate things, right? Because the only thing worse than automation that doesn't work is that automation that's just a little bit wrong, right? So, you know, snowflakes are a pretty dangerous thing. And if you have an organization that's very, you know, a ticket-driven, siloed organization, you're going to be, you know, blowing snowflakes out one end while your team on the other side is trying to automate things, right? Chasing your own tail. So if you think about ticket queues and these, you know, SRE principles, you know, they reinforce the siloed behavior. So all the things that made SLOs and with real consequences difference with silos are just made worse with this whole kind of ticket-driven culture. All the economic costs of bouncing around from all these queues eats up all the time. Good luck making tomorrow better than today. And, you know, these queues obfuscate that pressure that's being put on these people fulfilling the requests. Therefore, you know, a lot of workload is heaped upon them. You know, good luck trying to regulate your own workload. So next one's toil, excessive toil, I should say. And, you know, I've declared toil the enemy of SRE. I don't know if that's really true or not, but I love this out of the first SRE book. Vivek Rao has this great definition, so I'll just read it. Right? It says, toil is the kind of work tied to running a production service that tends to be manual, repetitive, automatable, because it should be automated, tactical, devoid of enduring value, which I think is a great litmus test there. Like, what am I doing? Am I building enduring value to my company with what I'm doing, or is this something that's just transitory and I just kind of have to do it to keep things going? And it scales linearly with the service. You know, if we go from 10,000 users to a billion users, do I need to linearly add this kind of work? Or am I going to see more of this work as we go? And I think this chart helps kind of break it down, right? Because a lot of enterprises, people see their job as that toil. Right? They're like, wait a minute, that's what I do. I toil in the digital salt mine all day long. And so you kind of have to really change their mindset to where, hey, that toil looks a little bit icky, right? So, you know, toil, it lacks enduring value. I'm not adding something that's really going to add value. And if you look at kind of the lean world, this is the concept of muda. It's a good way to look at this. Like, there's waste that is necessary. It's just stuff that's not adding enduring value, but you just have to do it to deliver to the customer. And then there's the waste that doesn't add value, is not necessary, you should just stop doing it. You know, versus engineering work, which is all about building enduring value, right? You know, the toil is kind of rote, repetitive, which can kind of feel nice sometimes, just getting that groove. But, you know, that's different from engineering work that takes the human brain, right? It takes creativity, it takes, you know, the ability to iterate on ideas. Toil is often very tactical. Engineering work tends to be more strategic. Strategic to move the business forward, or strategic to get rid of toil. Toil increases with scale versus engineering work that actually enables scaling. And toil can be automated. Engineering work, requires human creativity. So a lot of this kind of might seem like no duh, but I think if you work in a large organization, kind of really making this sink into people's heads, the difference between toil and engineering work is a key step. So why does this really matter, right? Because, toil eats up that engineering time, and then engineering time is needed for two things. You want to empower people to make tomorrow better than today. You want to empower people to make the business better. So they need that engineering work for making the business better and also for reducing toil, right? It kind of helps them get out of that tailspin. If that toil is at this kind of unmanageable percentage of a person's capacity, they're buried in that toil, they're not going to have any time to do engineering work, which is, number one, bad because they can't move the business forward. But number two, it's really bad because they're stuck in they're in a downward spiral, a death spiral, right? They don't have the capacity to even get out of the toil that they're buried under. So, that is really the deadly part of toil, is that it kills the engineering capacity of, or the creativity capacity of, your most expensive assets, which are your human beings, right? So back to our principles. We've got three of them here again. Remember that, if you're buried in excessive toil, it keeps the team from contributing engineering work to uphold their end of the shared responsibility deal, right? So it's like, oh, this thing is always breaking. We're always, we're blowing our air budget. Well, can't do anything about it. We're buried in all this toil. Obviously, if they're buried in toil, there's no capacity to make tomorrow better than today. And also buried in toil, there's no capacity for the engineering work to even reduce that toil. We can't control our own destiny. So last force here before we talk about happier things. Low trust is something that's kind of endemic to the enterprise. And, a really interesting thing about it is to think about where decisions made, right? So our people on our left here, right? The people with the hands on the keyboard, they're closest to the problem. They're closest to the business. They're closest to the customer, really, right? And they have all the context to make decisions. But yet, it's people 4 or 5 degrees away, right? The highest paid person in the room. That's who we're always turning to the enterprise to make these decisions. And constantly you see it happen in two ways, which is kind of a paralysis at the keyboard level. And also you see it in terms of escalations, right? Where things keep getting escalated. You have people in the NOC, or people that are watching the monitoring or holding the pager. They can't actually do anything, right? The first thing they do is escalate on up the chain. And it's a curious thing. So this guy, John Allspaugh, this is him at also the DevOps Enterprise Summit last year. He used to run all the technology at Etsy, and now he's actually an academic. He's a researcher in the field of human factors, which he hangs out with people that study like airplane crashes and nuclear power plants and trying to figure out how do we better operate complex systems. And he had this great thing where he asked the audience, is this dangerous, right? You kind of feel a little puckering when you see that. And he's like, yeah, but what if it's just a little routine that we run on a content cache every once in a while? Not so dangerous, right? Then he asked, is this dangerous, right? Yeah, I just changed a little case here, right? Feels pretty simple, doesn't feel dangerous at all, right? And he's like, well, what if I told you that it's a health check on a load balancer? Right? Suddenly now changing that is going to be a little dangerous. And his main point was, it's always, it depends, right? All the work that we do, running complex systems, the context always matters for the work that we do. So if that's the case, why do we have it so the people who have the most context to make those decisions are not the people making the decisions? It's the people that have the least amount of context that maybe haven't even touched that keyboard and other than for email in multiple years, right? It's a curious problem. And also, now we combine that low trust with our ticket systems, right? Now it really starts to get miserable, right? We have this illusion of control, which is, oh, we need to have all these approvals. We want to have approvals for everything that we do, right? And a very interesting kind of exercise, if you have this, where you have a lot of approvals going through ticket systems, go look at the approvals, figure out, number one, what's the total number of approvals that you had in this period of time? Which are the ones that were just information radiators? Something bad, scar tissue, something bad happened at one point, so now every VP needs to know every time somebody wants to go and do it. Subtract out the CYAs, right? Those like, oh, I just want to prove that I follow the process, so I'm going to route this through the organization. And then this is where it gets really kind of touchy, which is subtract the ones that the people doing the approvals are too far removed to actually judge whether that thing's good or bad, right? I call this messy, mostly guessing, right? They're just based on some past idea. Oh, sure, it doesn't seem too bad. Go ahead and do that. And, you know, ask yourself, how many are you really left with, right? And how many of those were the right call? And then how many of those actually got rejected? Good story. Back in the consulting days, we worked with a large U.S. insurance company. They had like about 2,000 people in their technology organization. Through the first 6 months of the year that we're working with them, they had over 25,000 distinct approvals go through their technology organization, right? We're talking like 300 people maybe, director level or above in the organization, and 25,000 approvals. And how many of those got rejected? It was like less than 1%. And you look at why, it was always like they didn't, you know, some procedural error. You didn't dot the I, you didn't cross the T, something like that. It was rarely ever because they're actually, you know, perceiving some sort of risk. So it becomes very dangerous when you have these low trust organizations and you're trying to, you know, kind of do the illusion of control of routing things through all these tickets. And it's very much, it kind of goes against, you know, sort of the SRE principle of, you know, being able to have that shared responsibility with an organization and really figure it out yourself. You see the high performing organizations in this model, they're the ones that empower the people closest to the keyboard to solve the problems. So low trust, right? You know, cultures of low trust have a really difficult time with shared responsibility. They just can't, you know, it just drives them nuts. So it's really hard to actually do. You know, people closest to the problem are the ones that have the context for it, but their tasking and their priorities and their decisions are largely out of their control. What's the chance that they're going to be able to make tomorrow better than today? And how are they going to convince somebody, you know, 6 degrees away that time should be allocated to them to fix their own problem? It's likely not going to happen. And if people aren't trusted to plan and design their own work, what's the chance of them regulating their own workload? So these are the four forces here. Sorry, just checking my time. And so what are we going to do about it, right? What can we do differently to change things? The first one is, you know, the concept of lean. You guys heard of lean? Something called Kaizen here in Europe, right? But it's the idea of, kind of came out of the Toyota production system, lean manufacturing world. But it's a way of looking at your processes and figuring out what's getting in the way and where are the wastes along the way. And there's a lot of kind of things here that you can learn. But the first idea is that all processes should be studied with an improvement discipline, right? People think, oh, well, there aren't processes really in the, you know, firefight, incident response kind of side of the world. But the reality is they are, right? They're just all ad hoc processes. But if you look at them, you'll find commonality and similarity across them, and each should be looked at as a process. And the interesting part of it, by starting with looking at failure versus looking at delivery, you really learn a lot about your organization, right? How do people actually work? How do they respond to stimulus? How do they, you know, how do they deal with the systems around them? So, you know, make sure that you're looking at your incidents with as much rigor as you do your delivery processes. We talk to the folks on the development side of the house. I guarantee you they're, you know, kind of using some type of methodology to study their delivery processes. Hopefully, maybe not, but hope they are. And then, you know, there's a lot of things you can learn from the lean world. A lot has been translated already to the DevOps context, and I think now will be applicable in the SRE context. You know, value stream mapping, like kind of like on the left here, right? We're going to, you know, get people in a room together, talk about, all right, that particular incident, what happened? Let's map out the process. You know, who did what? Who talked to who? What'd you talk to? Where'd you have to turn for that? You know, what happened? Where were the, you know, and then step two, what went wrong? What got in the way? What things were, you know, screwed us up? And that's kind of the red pen pass. And then last kind of pass being, all right, what can we do differently? What are the countermeasures we can put into place so, you know, these things won't happen again? Then we can turn that into actual little action plans and put that into people's backlogs to start to improve things. So these kind of discipline, these kind of process improvement already exists in most likely in other parts of your organization. Bring it into, you know, the SRE conversation as well. It's also very important because it's often have a hard time convincing executives that this, you know, these processes need to be fixed, right? Often they look at it as, oh, well, you know, just here's your ticket system, you know, work harder, right? And make it part of your organization's discipline. So kind of a more concrete step is, you know, getting rid of many of these silos as possible. We hear a lot about this as this cross-functional team idea. Let's try to start, you know, putting people on the same team, you know, so we have kind of the build and the run together. You know, that's kind of one of the ideas people throw out there. But, you know, key point number one is it's really just about getting rid of as many handoffs as possible, right? It's not really an org model decision as much as it is how can I connect people together that can be in the same context, use the same processes, use the same tools, not have those breaks in context. And really the key part is that it's a horizontal, you know, shared responsibility, not the everybody does everything, right? I think that's just a bad misconception about this this model. And org model doesn't really matter, right? Case in point, there is the, and this is cartoonish, right? The Netflix model, right? Which is, cross-functional teams, you know, the build and run, shared responsibility, the freedom of responsibility, they call it, right? Or there's the Google model, right? Again, cartoonish, don't say anything. Google friends over here. But, you know, there is a development team, there is an operations team called SRE, right? But they have these clear handoff requirements, they have the air budget consequences, in the same way that the Netflix model is building the shared responsibility by putting people on similar teams. The Google model is building shared responsibility with these other kind of tools and techniques. And guess what? Same high quality, same high velocity results. Both, you know, look at, both organizations are kind of known for their, the quality of how they build and run their services. So it's really about that shared responsibility more than any particular organization model. And why focus on these handoffs so much? Number one, your people are your most viable assets. You're hiring these SRE skill set, which is expensive, right? No more outsourcing to the cheapest location. We're building better, faster, stronger workers here. They're very expensive, so stay out of their way, right? And, you know, instead of having it where, okay, we're going to start with the backlog and then bounce them from ticket queue to ticket queue to ticket queue to ticket queue and all the problems we talked about before, get out of their way. You know, how do we put them together so they don't have those handoffs, don't have to bounce through those queues? And then we're reducing the friction, right? I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of an OODA loop. It came out of the U.S. Air Force. A guy named Boyd was the one who invented it around fighter pilots. It's sort of like the PDCA or almost like the scientific method, right? But the idea is, can you observe something? Can you orientate yourself to it? Can you make a decision and take action? And they realized that for human beings operating complex systems, like flying an airplane or running a nuclear power plant or, you know, running a complex web service, as long as the faster people can get through that loop, the better decisions are made. So, you know, invest in the right instrumentation, right? Get them the visibility that they need. Invest in, you know, the methods for collaboration, you know, checklists, getting the right tools to be able to investigate, issues. Empower them to make decisions. Empower them to take action and, you know, help people tighten up those loops. We're spending all this money on our people, make them better, right? So people say, all right, what about the handoffs, right? We can't get rid of, right? So we can't put all these specialists on every team. So what do we do, right? Aren't we stuck just back with the same old ticket queues? And how do we communicate across these different kind of cross-functional, horizontal responsibility, shared responsibility teams? Aren't we back at tickets? And that's really where this operations and service idea comes in. That's actually a name that my company, Rundeck, kind of invented, because we've seen a lot of organizations putting this together. Sometimes it's under the platform engineering team. Sometimes it's just something that happens organically in the SRE kind of transformation. But the idea is, how do you take those shared services, those capabilities, and turn them into pull-based services, right? So those teams can use them on demand when they need them. They could take, you know, they don't have to bounce into a ticket queue to get a firewall rule change. They don't have to bounce into a ticket queue to get a new environment or to scale something or to run a health check on something. They're taking that goodness and they're turning it into pull-based self-services. And the key thing is kind of like sort of imagine like EC2 versus like an old-fashioned managed service provider. Old-fashioned managed service provider, they might have given you a web interface to hit a button to get another one of something. But, you know, it was a bunch of human beings behind the scenes that would do it for you. And you really had no control over that button other than you can push it to get another one within a certain SLA. Compare that to how like EC2 works. Not only can you hit the button to get another one of those things, but you can actually define what that button does, right? And that's really where the operations and service model starts to be powerful, is empowering people who are typically outside of the normal kind of trusted operations domain. How do you empower them to run privileged operations tasks? And how do you empower them to actually define those tasks themselves as part of their delivery process, which gives us faster handoffs, which allows us to tighten those feedback loops and put people in control of their own destiny. And it works with any org model, right? I mean, it's not something that's really tied to this kind of cross-functional idea. And, you know, the popular use cases we see people building this operations as a service type capabilities. Number one, it's getting rid of the if I could fix it if I could get to it problem, right? The old, I know what that problem is, but I can't get to there. So now I've got to email or text or chat somebody who can do it, right? Versus empowering them, you know, empowering people outside of that operations to do privileged operations tasks themselves, right? And do that safely. Another use case is avoiding the dog pile, right? Which is one of our customers actually talked about this. It's like, you know, they're on a bridge call and they figure, I think this is, you know, box blah, blah, blah. And so you go and log into box blah, 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 and you run top, and the first 10 things you see are your colleagues running top on that box, right? So it's really a problem, those OODA loops, trying to make decisions, trying to figure out what's going on. And in organizations where you have the dog pile, right, you end up with this, you know, kind of a lot of guessing, a lot of try this, try that, everyone's silent, doing different things, and are we making progress? I don't know, you know, but we're, like, what's that old expression? We don't know where we're going. We don't know where we're going, but we're making good time, right? That's, you know, the dog pile. Versus having kind of an operations as a service idea to say, hey, there's one place that we're going to run these commands. Maybe it's an ad hoc command, or maybe it's a kind of a stored, like a shave job, like a checklist that we're running. But the idea is one person can run it, and everybody can see the output, right? We can kind of follow along and share that output with a broader crowd. Also helps when you have a lot of security issues, where it's like, well, how are we going to want to bring in some random developers to see a problem? You know, how are we going to let them do that in this environment without giving them direct access? We can't just like send them to Splunk and tell them to go dig around in the trash. You know, you have to give them something to look at. So that's another key one. Another favorite of mine is I don't read wikis. I'm an expert, right? So it's like, you know, at some point somebody goes, oh, wait a minute, this service has changed, right? There's a new flag you have to do or bad things are gonna blow up, right? And then somebody else from a different team says, hey, every time somebody restarts this thing, alarm bells go off and we all have to wake up. Can you please pause the monitoring before you do that, right? But what happens, right? You know, sooner or later someone has to restart something and it's like, I got this, I'm an expert, right? And they go and do it the way they've always done it because they don't read the wiki, right? I mean, somebody was talking yesterday about documentation. It was a great talk. But it kind of, you know, it brings up one of the problems with documentation, which is, especially in a firefight, nobody reads it, right? They go, I know what I'm doing, and they go and do it, and often makes things worse. Versus sort of with the operation of service idea, it's like, well, hey, if we're all working on defining these jobs, we can just say, hey, the service has changed, I'm going to change the restart job, right? Or, hey, we need to pause the monitoring first. I'll add another step that says pause the monitoring first. So now when our expert hero shows up and, you know, in 3 o'clock in the morning, I've done this before, I've got it, they run the same restart command, they think they're running the same restart command, yet we're actually running the new restart command, and, you know, things are a lot better. Uneven and hidden skills, right? This is huge in the enterprise, especially in very siloed organizations. You know, you got people, I don't know how to do something, but someone else does. I don't know where to find that person, you know, so on and so forth. Everybody's kind of siloed out. Versus sort of operation and service ideas, hey, you know, I know how to do X. I know how to make these standard firewall changes. Somebody else needs to make this standard firewall rule change. Maybe it's every time we add a new partner, we have to spin up a sandbox for them to test out the APIs. It means we've got to punch a little hole in the firewall. You know, let that person in the firewall team define that procedure. Other people can use it. And now it's not just the kind of one-off situations. We can start to build more of these, you know, build upon these building blocks. And then, you know, often the classic one, right? You guys all live this one, right? You know, let me do that for you again, and then do it again, and then do it again, and then do it again. And while you're doing that, you know, that's taking up all your time, and the world's burning behind you because you're not getting to the other things that you need to be doing. Versus sort of the operations service mindset is, you know, hey, I'm going to set up a job for you to do it yourself, right? This is the kind of Tom Sawyer, you know, have people paint your fence for you idea, which is encourage them to even create these own jobs themselves. You look at them, say, yeah, that's pretty good. That's going to work. You give them permission to run it. Now you can focus on the other more pressing issues or things that you never would have gotten to before because you're able to offload a lot of that labor. So it gets us back to tickets, right? People are like, you know, oh, but tickets, I love tickets. You know, what are tickets actually good for, right? Number one, documenting true problems, issues, exceptions, right? Trouble tickets, that was the original idea, right? So they are great for that, right? If that service doesn't do what, operations of service doesn't do what you expect it to do, then you can file a ticket. Or you have an enhancement idea, file a ticket, right? Or something is really, you know, not making sense, file a ticket. Second is, you know, especially in enterprises, you're just going to have regulatory reasons or compliance reasons or some other reason that you have to actually have a valid approval process or a paper trail that showed that you followed some kind of approval process. So ticket systems are actually pretty good at that. It's better than doing it in email. But where the problems lie and we really have to get out of is using ticket systems as a general work management system, right? That everything I do has to bounce through this ticket system. That's just all the problems we talked about before. And then it comes up, well, blah, blah, you know, security, compliance, won't they stop you, right? And the reality is, at first, maybe, right? They usually get a little scared and you say, oh, we're going to let people outside of the traditional operations run privileged operations tasks. They're like, no, you're not, right? But if you really talk through it, the reality is, what's their idea of control today? It's like, oh, we got this ticket system, we route this thing for approvals, and then it finally gets to somebody, and they go and do something, and they come back, and they write done, right? You have no idea what actually happened. So, you know, with this kind of operations and service idea, you're now building all that evidence collection into the system, right? So you can, you know, build the, you know, the access control policies and security into it. You can also, you know, build all the compliance checks into it as well. You now have the full audit trail. Who did what? When did they do it? You know, what ticket was it tied to if you have to do that? And so it really becomes a place for you to put that compliance and security into your platform. And kind of one more thing here. People say, well, what about ITIL, right? How many folks encounter ITIL in their organizations? Yeah, folks, yeah, okay. Sorry. So, you know, you ask ITIL people, right? And they say, oh, SRE is ITIL compatible, right? It's no problem. You ask people who have seen ITIL implemented, and they're like, how, right? How is that? How is that possible? And the reality is, if you look at, this is kind of an unsolved problem here, but if you look at Agile, DevOps, SRE, they have this self-regulation and shared responsibility features that totally kind of undermine the command and control ideas of ITIL. And, you know, people focus in on this standard change idea. I say, well, it's, you know, it's a standard change. You know, so in ITIL, that means that you've done something that's been approved before. Someone told you could do it. And you've done it, like, I think it's 3 times or 5 times. It's now classified as a standard change. So therefore, you don't need approval anymore, right? But it still implies that you did this thing before and somebody improved it. It doesn't really talk about, you know, this idea of kind of self-regulation. If you think about what continuous delivery is about building the systems to make yourself safer. If you think about SRE and its shared responsibility model, it's about being in control of your own destiny and working it out with the business and the development stakeholders in real time to stay within the bounds of that safety. It's very different than kind of where the ITIL model has gone. Not to say there aren't a lot of good kind of vocabulary and definitions and things in the ITIL books. They're actually not the worst read. I've actually read them. But it's just, you know, the question is, you know, are we doing these contortions to defend the sunk cost that we've all spent going down this path in operations? It's a debate that needs to be had. And I think SRE is driving that. So a couple more things here. Shift left, the ability to take action, right? You got to push that control as far left as possible. Empower the people closest to the keyboard to do it. Part of that is just cultural and organizational enablement. Also, a lot of that is tooling. How do we give those people, the level one folks, as close to as possible, all of the tools and the skills and the guardrails that they need? And the kind of operations and service, again, helps with that type of problem. Reduce toil, right? Track the toil levels for each team. Just do it, right? Most people don't. Set the toil limits for each team. And then fund the efforts to reduce toil, right? Too many people say, oh, well, you know, solve your own problems. We need to kind of swarm and help folks that their teams are over those limits. I know in the Google books, they talk about 50%. I've seen, you know, teams kind of go back and forth whether that's a good idea, but set a limit and stick to it. Start a book club. Unlike, you know, the DevOps movement and a lot of other things, there's actually a real definition, right? They've started with the books, great books. Shockingly, most people have not read these books. Right, you have to use the word SRE, and they say we're going to do SRE in our enterprise. So some are free. I actually wrote a chapter for the new one, Seeking SRE, on the right here, coming out pretty soon. So recap, SRE is more than a title, right? Number two, really understand the forces undermining SRE, right? If you don't do that, it's a non-starter. We're just changing job titles, and no one's going to be happier, or no one's going to be happy. Focus on removing those silos and queues. You know, really leverage kind of the operations of service idea, shift left to control and decision making, and reduce toil to create capacity to change. So Rundeck, we're kind of taking on ourselves to kind of see around the industry and We see a lot in our open source community and also our commercial customers kind of building this operations as a service idea. Again, we came up with a name, just trying to put a label on it, but we're really trying to document the pattern that we see. You can go to that URL. There's a kind of an early, it's pretty much a book that you can read online that talks about these ideas. And you can always hit me on Twitter or shoot me an email. Love talking about this stuff. And thank you very much.